Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, some volunteers from Illinois head to swing states to campaign for their presidential candidate, and we'll tag along. Studies show beef has a negative impact on greenhouse gas emissions. Can you still enjoy a hamburger and keep your climate conscience clean? We'll have a report on the nation's first commercial carbon sequestration facility. It's in central Illinois, and it's leaking. We'll discuss what's happening at colleges in the first year since race-based admissions were banned. Western Illinois University is dealing with big budget problems. One part of the campus feeling the impact, librarians. An exoneree from Illinois is working to increase compensation for those wrongfully convicted. And we'll go hunting for a mysterious creature, the Mothman. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. With Vice President Kamala Harris expected to win the state of Illinois, hundreds of Democratic volunteers from here are spending their weekends volunteering in swing states like Wisconsin and Michigan. They're knocking on doors of potential voters. Many of the volunteers want to talk about issues like abortion rights. Kristen Schorsch tagged along one day.
It's a Saturday morning in September, and I'm at the headquarters of the New Trier Democrats in Winnetka. About 40 volunteers circle up in a courtyard. Some sip coffee as they wait to carpool to Racine, Wisconsin to knock on doors. Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky is here to pump them up. She says there's so much at stake in the swing states. They decide who becomes president.
It's all about turnout, turnout, and turnout. This is not rocket science. You don't have to know everything about politics.
Schakowsky mentions a big topic on her mind that could energize voters. She says Wisconsin doesn't have the worst rules on abortion rights, but that they're pretty bad. This is the first presidential election since Roe v. Wade overturned more than 2 years ago. Back to the circle, volunteers who need a ride raise their hands, get some instructions, and head to Racine. I hop in a car with volunteers Mark Steen and Elizabeth Posner.
I have Cliff Bars. I have some chips.
We talk about why they're spending a Saturday driving an hour north to talk to strangers. Posner is the volunteer board chairwoman of Planned Parenthood Illinois Action. She has reproductive rights on her mind.
I went to my first march for women's rights in the 80s, and I can't believe 40 years later that I'm still doing it.
Now she has three adult kids who, she points out, don't have the same rights she did. Steen is the canvas captain driving us up north. He says he knocks on doors in Wisconsin most weekends, and even though he's rooting for Harris, he says he enjoys talking to people even if they don't agree with him. We get to the Racine Democrats headquarters. There's a long line sneaking out the door where the volunteers learn how to talk to potential voters today, like be nice, don't argue. Then they fan out across Racine. I meet Sarah Cantor with her husband and young son. They decided in June to come to Wisconsin every month until the election.
And the kids all rolled their eyes. I have a 13-year-old who was like, oh, not again. So she got to stay home today, as did our 10-year-old. I want our kids to see what civic engagement looks like. I want them to be exposed to ideas outside of our Chicago bubble. And I hope that they remember this one day and that they realize that it can make a difference.
Then I hop back in the car with Steen and Posner and head out to a quiet neighborhood to knock on doors.
All right, we're here. Okay.
There are pumpkins and scarecrows, but not a lot of political yard signs. They have some luck as Steen sees Omar Correa walking out of his garage.
Nice to meet you, Omar.
Nice to meet you.
Any issues on your mind coming up for the election?
No, not really.
Really?
No.
All right. Do you think you're going to vote?
I will vote, yeah.
Yeah. Do you have a sense? Or you in?
I will, yeah.
All right.
Trump, yeah.
You're going to go with Trump all the way? Tell me a little bit about what gets you there.
Well, I just think he has the best interest for this nation going forward. That's
yeah.
He politely takes some literature about Democratic candidates. Then Steen and Posner head next door, where Correa's neighbor Mike has the opposite point of view.
We are not voting for Trump.
As Steen and Posner walk the neighborhood, they don't wade much into controversial topics like abortion rights. And they talk about how people can be nice, even if they don't agree.
We all have this shared common humanity, and there are folks who'd like to let us think we don't, but we do. And coming up to places where there's just a little more political ideology diversity is really great.
This is the point for a lot of the volunteers. It's about trying to make a connection while they also try to do their part to win Wisconsin for Harris. Kristen Schorsch, WBEZ News.
Stateville Correctional Center had some of the worst conditions of any Illinois prison. It also had some of the best education programs. This spring, Governor Pritzker announced the facility will be torn down and rebuilt. All of the men housed there now have been transferred to other sites. But over 100 of them were taking higher education courses, including 8, who are ready to graduate with their bachelor's degrees. Emily Hayes has more on what's happening with them.
For the first time in 2 decades, Robert Curry has a window.
I'm able to see the world.
In September, he was transferred from Stateville near Joliet to Hill Correctional Center in Galesburg.
I'm able to see things like the highway from the yard.
Curry was convicted of murder in 2006, but maintains his innocence. He was sent to maximum security prisons, including Stateville.
I'm able to open a window and get fresh air, so those are positives.
Another positive with the move is his education. He's still able to study with Northeastern Illinois University, DePaul University, and the Prison Neighborhood Arts Education Project.
It was something that I never thought, never considered getting a degree at all. Associate's, bachelor's, or master's. I never had any aspirations to go to college. I didn't think it was in my cards.
Since 2017, Northeastern's University Without Walls program has provided a consistent pathway for men at Stateville to pursue a degree. The goal, according to Professor Erica Miners, is to honor their previous learning, which includes coursework as well as published books, new legal theories, and nationally exhibited artwork.
They were coming into the program as 30-year-olds, as 40-year-olds, as 50-year-olds, as 60-year-olds with decades of prior learning, decades of university-level prior learning. So this program allows us to make those assessments.
But when a judge ordered the site to be vacated early, Miner says they rushed to schedule the final academic requirement, a review board presentation for the 8 men in their graduating cohort. Robert Curry presented his on September 11th, the day before he was transferred. 5 of his classmates, though, were sent to different facilities, and they can no longer have contact with one another.
We depend on each other. You know, we confer to each other, confide in each other. So those are relationships that you don't normally develop in a place like this. And we were able to do that.
The University Without Walls program had planned to do a graduation ceremony for the cohort in late October. Miner says they will find a way to celebrate their recent graduates.
We're now just reassessing, and the hope is to do it in the spring, you know, March, April, May. And the hope is to do it potentially at Hill, get people moved to Hill. But, you know, that hasn't been confirmed by the Department of Corrections.
If Curry's classmates aren't transferred to Hill, they may no longer have access to higher education programs, which are not always offered. Curry says being angry about the classes being split up isn't productive, but he is
frustrated, to say the least. But I know that our DOC has no agenda to do right by us, regardless of the strides we make for ourselves.
It's his hope that he and the other students will eventually be reunited and get to experience a graduation ceremony with their families. In a statement, the Illinois Department of Corrections says the majority of the students taking higher education courses at Stateville were transferred to facilities where they can continue to study. For those who weren't, it says they may request a transfer after being in their current location for 3 months. I'm Emily Hayes.
Halloween is just around the corner, and you don't have to look that far for some spooky mysteries. The Chicago region has had several reports of a giant flying winged humanoid. They began in 2011 and continued for many years. And our friends at the Curious City podcast decided to check it out in 2019 with a monster hunt.
Got my boots. I have a bat microphone too. Got all kinds of high-tech stuff, but when it comes down to it, they won't protect us. And we're gonna find Mothman. Hi, I'm Robbie Telfer, and I recently ventured out into the woods under a full moon for a very important reason: monster hunting. It all began with curious citizen Sarah Beacon, a Chicago comics artist.
There was a rash of sightings within the city limits of Chicago in 2017 of a creature that people then called the Chicago Mothman. And did we ever find out what it was?
That's right, the Chicago Mothman. It's often described as a 6 or 7 foot tall, neckless, red-eyed, winged fellow. We have to say Chicago Mothman to distinguish our guy from the original Mothman. The legends started in Point Pleasant, West Virginia in the late 60s. There were dozens of reported sightings of a Mothman there. And shortly after those, a large bridge collapsed, killing 46 people. Since then, some consider Mothman to be a portent of doom. In the decades since, the West Virginian Mothman has become pretty famous with its own festival, museum, and a 2002 movie starring the Richard Gere. But now, people have been reporting lots of new sightings in Chicago. The Phantoms and Monsters website has been tracking those reports.
And I know there's about 90 sightings on there right now, but the bulk of them were focused on the city of Chicago.
They start in 2011, peak in 2017. Mothman has been reported all over Chicagoland. To try to answer Sarah's question, what are people actually seeing, I'm going to talk to some scientists and tell you what happened on that monster hunt. But first, I tracked down someone who saw something strange one day in 2017 in the Westtown neighborhood.
So you saw Mothman?
I think so.
This is Erin Drain. She's a wine importer and, from what I can tell, moored to reality.
So I was spending the afternoon on a rooftop. I saw something in the sky fairly high up and fairly far away. It wasn't being like buffeted about by the wind. It was moving slowly, but not randomly, I guess.
Her report is similar to many others.
But you took a video.
I did take a video.
It's about 10 seconds long. Pretty far away, but undeniable. Something large, dark, suspended in the sky, like a spider whose invisible web makes it appear to be stuck, impossibly, midair.
I want to believe.
I know. Okay, so that's the thing.
Don't we all?
Yes, I want to believe too. And we are not alone. There's actually a whole field concerned with unknown creatures called cryptozoology. Dr. Angelo Caparella is a biologist from Illinois State University and dabbles in cryptozoology.
I would define cryptozoology as the scientific study of undescribed animals that are being reported, but don't seem to match anything that's actually known to science at this time. The kinds of things that travelers would report, indigenous peoples knew about.
Scientists agree there are definitely undescribed species out there. And Mothman could be one of those, right? Well,
I can't think of any even close analogy to flying humanoids in the fossil record and the known biological record of any kind today or in the past. It just flies in the face of everything that we think we know about the natural world. Sasquatch, on the other hand, I think you can make a case for it being a solid cryptid that is worth further investigation.
So, to be clear, the guy who thinks Bigfoot might be out there says Mothman is just too much. Well, poo. Maybe Mothman isn't real. So, what are people seeing? It turns out there's plenty of explanations for why we might see monsters. One theory is that it's an evolutionary adaptation. Humans tend to see human-like forms where there aren't any. The idea is it draws our attention to possible threats just to be safe. Or maybe we're priming ourselves to see Mothman because we've heard other people saw Mothman. Also, sometimes people lie on purpose. I know that's hard to hear. Still, there is a teeny tiny part of me that can't completely abandon the idea of Mothman. And I'm not the only one. Dr. Phil Willink, who is a fish biologist by day, has long been fascinated by Chicago monster sightings.
So, you're a scientist, Phil. Why are you interested in this stuff?
I think it's the mystery. There's a puzzle. What is going on? Because something is going on. What is going on is potentially really, really interesting.
Back to my monster hunt. Willink and I, two grown men, walk around the woods at night searching for something we don't believe in. We chose Woodstock, Illinois for two reasons. One, because there have been recent Mothman sightings here. And two, it's Friday the 13th, and it's a full moon. Spooky!
February 22, 2019, it was spotted at Dewfield Pond Road, off of Country Club Road. It was described as 8 to 9 feet tall, with membrane wings and dark fur, and it ran across the road in front of somebody.
We're less than a mile from where that happened. We walk deeper into the woods.
I don't see anything now.
We hear some coyotes barking and some raccoons screeching. And when we turn around to leave, we notice a shadow.
It looks kind of like a person, right?
It does. I keep hearing noises over there, too. It totally looks like it. But what is it?
I'll turn on a light. That doesn't help.
Well, we gotta go that way anyways.
So we might as well meet our doom. Tree. It's a tree.
Oh, yeah, Christmas tree. All right, well, there you go.
Like a little pointy-headed Mothman.
That tree was freaking me out. Once your imagination gets going, you can turn anything into a Mothman.
We went looking for Mothman, and what we really found was ourselves. And a scary-ass Christmas tree. I still can't quite answer Sarah's question or say what people have been seeing here. Look, we see unexplainable stuff all the time and have to rely on our own experiences and beliefs to fill in the blanks. Things that may have been common to previous generations, like an owl or even a tree, can become monstrous to city folk like me. By and large, monsters may be more familiar to us than owls. These feelings aren't facts, but they're not fiction either. But let's just imagine, for a moment, that Mothman really is real. It's come to Chicago, and it's warning us of something. I put the question to Aaron.
What do you think he could have been warning you about?
Looking at our phones too much. Looking down. You can learn a lot by looking up.
Reporting for the story was done by me, Robbie Telfer. Support comes from the Conant Family Foundation.
The folks at the Curious City podcast have not given up their search for the Mothman, even delving into it again this year, but no evidence was found. Something to look out for this Halloween season. There is more ahead on Statewide. Stay with us. And we're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Last year, Illinois passed a law to provide free school meals, but they didn't fund it, so it hasn't happened. Many schools still offer the free meals to all students. Peter Medlin went to a school cafeteria to see what it looks like.
The executive chef chops onions for a homemade salsa. Around the corner, cooks pinch pizza dough and dishes clang in the sink. A few feet away, hundreds of customers pour in, order, and leave in minutes. Today, they'll serve upward of 1,700 meals. Welcome to the biggest and busiest restaurant in town, DeKalb High School.
Last year we served 1.15 million meals, and we're already trending for more.
That's Mike Chamness. He's the food service manager at DeKalb Public Schools.
Hi, friend. What can I get you today?
That's Tiffany. She's one of the school's food workers, guiding a line of students through her station.
I've got two choices for you today. I got my stir fry, and I also got a chili cheese dog.
I'll do stir fry.
All right, friend.
This first rush just started. Students will come through 200 at a time, and it really won't slow down for another 4 hours. And the workers have been prepping this food since 6 a.m. And DeKalb students have a lot of options. There's pasta, a deli, salad, stir-fry, pizza, a Chipotle-style burrito bar, grab-and-go station, and, of course, a daily special. Today, it's the chili dog. There are more options this year thanks to the district's new partnership with food vendor Organic Life. Connor Artiega is the food service director with Organic Life.
We have to offer all five of our components, which are your grains, your meat-meat alternate, your fruit or vegetable, and then your milk. They must take three out of the five for lunch, and one of which has to be a half a cup of fruit or a vegetable.
DeKalb offers free meals to every student, breakfast and lunch, no matter their age or income.
Unfortunately, some of our students, it could be the only meals they get every day, but definitely the healthiest meals.
That's Mike Chamness again, and he says the benefits don't just end there.
Yeah, there's less trips to the nurse's office. A lot of times kids were going to the nurse's office when all it was is they were hungry, you know, so there's less trips to the nurse's office. We have improved
behavior in the district.
Most studies show universal meals lead to fewer disciplinary issues and increase academic performance. The food program looks a little different at the middle and elementary schools. For example, they serve breakfast in the classrooms at those levels.
Which also removes that stigma. Everybody's eating at the same time, where before there was an option, well, you can go outside and play with your friends, or you can come in and eat breakfast.
But at DeKalb, universal meals are a relatively new thing. They've been offering them for 4 years. During the pandemic, the federal government allowed all schools to offer free meals, and that expired in 2022. But after many schools, like DeKalb, saw the positives, they couldn't go back. Roxanne Ramage is with the Illinois State Board of Education, and she says it's a trend they've seen across Illinois.
We did see some growth after that pandemic feeding and continuing to support kids, and it's great when the kids can come to school and not have to worry about any of that.
DeKalb qualifies for universal meals through the community eligibility provision. It's a federal program where schools can offer free meals if a certain percentage of students qualify for federal assistance like Medicaid or SNAP.
It was 40% until this school year, and then the federal government changed that, and that reduced that percentage down to 25%.
Now more schools qualify, but Ramage says they haven't seen a big increase in participation. That's because the fewer students who qualify for federal assistance, the lower the school's reimbursement rate, so it's not financially feasible for some schools. Illinois did pass a universal free meals law last year. The problem is that they didn't fund it. The law's sponsor, Maurice West, introduced another bill this year to devote $200 million annually to the program, but it didn't pass. If it does pass at some point, the food staff in DeKalb think it could make a massive difference. They say kids having access to meals every day doesn't just fill their stomachs. It fuels their bodies so they can play tag during recess and powers their brains so they can focus on their homework and builds a foundation for a healthy life. I'm Peter Medlin.
This fall, the racial demographics of first-year students at selective colleges are under the microscope. Last year, the Supreme Court all but banned universities from considering the race of applicants in order to diversify their campuses. Now, enrollment numbers are coming in for the first freshman class admitted under the new legal precedent, and people are poring over the data to gauge its impact. Lisa Curry and Philip talked with the policy director of the nonprofit Education Reform Now, James Murphy, about what he sees in the numbers and the pitfalls of reading too much into them.
There's been a lot of coverage of the racial demographics of the freshman class this year. Why has there been so much interest? The institutions impacted by the decision are tiny, right, in terms of the percentage of students they serve.
On the one hand, should we have been as curious about the outcome of the SFFA decision? Maybe not, in the sense of most students were not affected by this. Most institutions of higher education weren't affected by it. On the other hand, these small number of colleges send a lot of students into politics, into entrepreneurship, off to law schools and med schools and PhD programs. And so they matter in that sense. And this was the first year that they were admitting a class without the option, or without the power, I should say, to consider race in the admissions process.
Is there anything that the data can tell us about the impacts of the decision?
Nothing is based on any single factor, right? Even legacies don't get in because they're legacies. Even donors' kids don't get in because they're, I mean, maybe once you get into the 10 million plus spectrum, maybe. Nobody's getting in because of any one thing, right? College admissions is complex. There's a lot of competing priorities. And so it's not actually surprising that there isn't a good, clear pattern on the outcome for Hispanic students, Asian American students, and white students.
What are your concerns about reporters covering this data and trying to interpret it in the context of the Students for Fair Admissions decision?
It's very early, right? So the data that's been released is preliminary data. And probably most importantly of all, it's a single year. Every year has its, you know, tensions and dramas at many colleges. So a single year of data compared especially to just 1 year of data, so last year's class, is not a very good way to figure out what on earth is going on.
At Northwestern and U of I, the numbers stayed relatively stable. Like, for example, I think at U of I, the percentage of Black students went from 5.4% to 4.9%. I'm wondering if you have any takeaways from those schools that are local to Illinois.
It's not too much in the sense of like, because we don't know why these outcomes happen. They were doing something in their admissions process to really prioritize diversity, but maybe not. It could have honestly just been luck.
So Northwestern shouldn't necessarily be padding its the percentage of Black students went up from 14% to 15%.
I'll give them a pat on the back, but just, you know, let's wait to see what happens next year and the year after and the year after that. It's hard work, right? The thing about enrolling a diverse class is that it is challenging when you have taken away the primary tool that would help a college enroll a diverse class of students. All the proxies in the world are probably not going to make up for the difference.
That's Education Reform Now Policy Director James Murphy, and he spoke with Lisa Curry and Phillip about the first freshman class to enter college under a near ban on the consideration of race in admissions. U.S. beef production is responsible for about 4% of the nation's planet-warming pollution. That's according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Some researchers say eating less beef could lower emissions. But for some people, that is easier said than done. Harvest Public Media's Elizabeth Rembert sees if there's a way to order a hamburger while keeping your climate conscience clean.
From her home in eastern Nebraska, Angie O'Brien does what she can to help the environment. She reduces, reuses, and recycles, and tries to be more aware of where her food comes from, like beef, which she often buys from nearby ranchers.
I've just figured if it's a local cow, I always feel like that's a little bit better.
Beef in particular can drive up a person's contributions to climate change. One study found that swapping out beef can slash your diet's emissions footprint by about half for that day. But O'Brien's not looking to cut the red meat out completely.
No. Girl, we're in the beef states.
For people like O'Brien, who care about their actions' impacts on the earth and also think a hamburger sounds really good, is there a way to eat beef sustainably?
I don't know if I would use sustainable eating of beef in the same sense.
That's Diego Rose. He leads the nutrition program at Tulane University in New Orleans. His research tallied the environmental impact of nearly 17,000 people's diets for one day. Running down the list, most foods clocked in around the same.
And then all of a sudden we'd hit one that was like 10 times more or 100 times more than anything else, and invariably that was beef.
Cow burps are a lot of what's packing the environmental punch. That's according to Aaron Smith. He's an agricultural economist at the University of California, Berkeley. You may have heard of cow farts as the culprit.
So people like to say farts because it's more fun or funny to talk about, but it really is all almost all burps.
The burps release methane, which is a powerful planet-warming pollution that contributes to climate change. Methane stays in the atmosphere far less time than carbon dioxide. But methane traps a ton of heat at a moment when scientists say emissions must come down drastically. Some ranchers are thinking of how their cattle impact the environment. About 20 years ago, Jim Kanopic switched how he raised cattle on his central Nebraska ranch. He wanted to take better care of his soil and water.
What I really want is clean water for the next generation and a good environment and good clean food.
Kanopic is headed out on a four-wheeler to check on his cows. Now, instead of keeping cattle in the same field for months, he rotates them frequently to smaller bits of pasture. It's called mob grazing, and the idea is the cows help the soil by stamping organic material into the ground, and it gives grasses time to recover between grazing. Kanopic ushers about 500 cows into a fresh section of pasture by winding up a twine fence. The herd ambles in and gets to work on the tall grasses.
You see how they quieted down now, now they're just busy.
Kanopic sees the environmental benefits on his ranch. His soils are healthier, even in times of drought. Most of these cattle Kanopic raises will end up at a feedlot eating grain. Some researchers say letting cows eat grass their whole lives may reduce the overall impact cattle have on the environment by improving the soil and using less water. But raising cows 100% on grass could end up having a bigger impact on climate change. It takes longer for cows to gain weight when they only eat grass, so they live longer and emit more methane.
Strictly from a greenhouse gas standpoint, it's hard to say that grass finishing cattle is good for the environment.
That's Al Rotz with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He points out things like improving soil quality and water use also matter to the environment. But ultimately, Rott says substantially lowering the emissions footprint of U.S. beef is a long shot. He doubts it can ever become carbon neutral, balancing out emissions by removing an equal amount.
5-10%, maybe even 15% reduction? Yeah. 50% reduction? Carbon neutral? No.
That's why Diego Rose with Tulane University says the answer is simple.
Yeah, eat less. I mean, if you're trying to reduce your carbon footprint, eat less beef.
That's more doable for Angie O'Brien. She says she might cut back a little bit.
Yeah, I can go a few days, but then I'm like, oh, a hamburger really sounds good.
For O'Brien and other beef eaters, eating less can be a part of the solution to lowering their emissions on the dinner plate. I'm Elizabeth Rembert, Harvest Public Media.
Over the last 2 years, several large pork packing plants have closed in California, Minnesota, and most recently Iowa. Rachel Kramer has more on what it means for some pork producers and why the industry is encountering economic turbulence.
On his farm near Gowrie in central Iowa, Larry Alliger walks toward a row of low-roofed hog barns.
I need to weigh about 190 pounds. 180.
Alliger says the pigs inside have another month and a half to reach market weight. He buys piglets from Colorado with his son, and between both of their operations, he says they can have around 20,000 pigs on hand. The Alligers sell them to Tyson Foods. Inside another barn, the hogs are noticeably larger.
We start loading these tomorrow, 3 o'clock.
3 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, we have 2 loads in the morning that go to Storm Lake. So.
Hauling hogs to the Tyson Pork Processing Plant over 70 miles to Storm Lake, Iowa, is a big change for Alliger. For 35 years, he almost always went to the one in Perry, which was half the distance, until it shut down in June. Alliger says he was disappointed when he heard the news, but not necessarily surprised given the economic challenges across the industry. In 2023, producers in Iowa and the U.S. suffered record losses as costs outpaced profits.
It's been pretty brutal in the last year and a half, and even on Tyson's side, you know. They had a pretty tough year a year ago, so. And if they don't make money, then they can't afford to pay more either, so.
Tyson reported a $648 million drop in income for fiscal year 2023. The company said it closed the single shift plant in Perry to make overall operations more efficient. Alliger says he's committed to sell to Tyson, but the Perry plant closure will mean more time on the road, an hour and 40 minutes to Storm Lake, versus 45 minutes to Perry for each load of hogs. And extra minutes and miles cost more money. Tom Berkren is the former executive director of the American Association of Swine Veterinarians.
It's really more than just an inconvenience for pork producers to lose a plant like this.
He says nearly 100 pork producers, many of whom were his clients, had contracts with the Tyson plant in Perry. Most were shifted to the company's other plants in Iowa.
It's real dollars that they have to spend on transportation, and if they have an employee driving the truck, it's longer hours on the road, and so I really feel bad for producers.
Lee Schultz is an Iowa State Extension livestock economist. To help explain why producers and packers have had several rough years, Schultz points to higher costs for labor, energy, and insurance, along with elevated interest rates and inflation. He says some producers may have spent more money to retrofit facilities or build new ones to comply with California's Proposition 12. The law requires more space for hogs in order for the pork to be sold in the state.
But also you have the auditing and certification process and the tracing of the product and all that adds additional costs to the system.
These costs come on top of long-term shifts in the supply of hogs and capacity to process them. After years of upward growth in the number of hogs, Schultz says pork packers increased their slaughter capacity nearly 10% between 2016 and 2020. They built new plants or upgraded existing ones to be more efficient.
We've seen now hog inventories roughly stabilize. Pork demand has softened a bit since 2020 and 2021.
And packers are adjusting to minimize losses. Schultz says companies with multiple operations will shut down their least profitable, highest cost sites when times get tough. Smithfield Foods closed one of its processing plants in California last year and recently announced the same fate for its ham boning facility in Altoona, Iowa. High Life also closed a plant in southwest Minnesota, and Olimel shuttered several in Canada. The concern is that there's less cushion to adjust to possible disruptions in the supply chain, and that cushion gets thinner each fall when there are more hogs ready for market. I'm Rachel Kramer.
More to come on Statewide. Stay right here. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Well, the state of Illinois could pay more to those wrongfully convicted. As of now, the amount Illinois offers is well below many other states. But there is a push to increase compensation, and an exoneree is helping with the effort. Isabella Nieto has more.
In 1988, Brian Beals was a college senior at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale eyeing a career in law enforcement. He'd been a football player and made a trip home for Thanksgiving break. He didn't realize his life was about to change. Back in Chicago's Englewood neighborhood, a mother and her son were shot along a city street. The child, a six-year-old, died. The mother identified the shooter as Beals. He was found guilty and sentenced to 80 years behind bars. The problem is that Beals was innocent. He would go on to serve 35 years for the shooting. A long legal effort finally resulted in his sentence being vacated last year, and Beals walked free on December 12th. Beals says he was trapped into a system that wasn't working for the people of his community. He says he isn't the first from his neighborhood to be wrongfully convicted.
To give you an example, there's another exoneree who grew up two houses down from me and one that grew up two blocks across from me. That neighborhood was like so many people were wrongfully convicted from their community.
Beals had chosen to study law enforcement because he grew up playing on sports teams coached by former police officers. Now, after his experience with the criminal justice system.
You know, I can't help but feel that a lot of the reforms that are necessary, people really need to get more involved in analyzing and voting the right way to make sure that these reforms and that politicians are looking at it correctly.
While his family and others worked tirelessly to get him out of prison, he maintained hope. But he admits after the Supreme Court overturned a lower court decision for a new trial, his hopes of release were at an all-time low.
When you were incarcerated, you literally lose your citizenship, your liberty, you know, you're disenfranchised. You don't have a chance to vote on any of these issues.
Now that Beals is free, more focus has been placed on compensating him for the years of his life that were taken away. Exonerees must file a case with the Illinois Court of Claims. Illinois has more exonerations than any other state, but compensation for the formerly incarcerated is well below the national average. It's also capped at just over $200,000 total. In Beals' case, that would equate to around $6,000 a year for the time he spent locked up. That's less than half the poverty line. State Senator Doris Turner wants to see change. She's working with the Illinois Innocence Project, which helped Beals get out of prison, to raise the payment amount to $50,000 per year, capped at $2 million.
As you know, Illinois has really become a national leader in with regard to criminal justice reform.
Turner, a Springfield Democrat, says the page is turning in the General Assembly toward criminal justice reform. She says people being elected to serve are more in tune with their communities. Lauren Caseberg is the legal director at the Innocence Project. She says Beals' sister had gathered witness statements that helped them prove Beals' innocence.
I mean, what we're talking about here are people who were taken from their lives, thrown into prison for crimes they didn't commit, take years, most often decades, to get back into court and prove their innocence.
Caseberg also says the 2024 compensation bill would give exonerees restitution at a personal and financial level.
You were wronged by this state. The state of Illinois wrongfully convicted you and incarcerated you for all these years. And because of that, you were deprived of the opportunity to work, to raise a family, to own a home, to pay into a pension, to pay into Social Security.
Brian Beals says his years in prison inspired him to continue to advocate for reform measures.
Spending so many years in prison, being a part of that community, being an activist and a community builder, and I do feel a responsibility to come out, you know, just not just for the inside community, but for the outside community well and give my perspective on these issues. It's very important.
Beals is waiting to bring his request for compensation to the state. If the law is changed to provide increased payments, it's unlikely to apply to past cases. Supporters are hopeful lawmakers take action soon so that Beals can be paid for so much of his life that was taken from him. I'm Isabella Nieto.
Western Illinois University is laying off all of its library faculty. They're being let go as the administration strives to close a multi-million-dollar budget gap. Rich Egger reports the decision has some people wondering, how can you have a library without librarians?
Western's new administration inherited the budget gap. This summer, as part of a plan to fix the university's finances, it announced the layoffs of more than 100 people from across campus. Hunter Dunlap is one of those affected. He's been a professor and librarian at Western for more than 27 years, but not for much longer.
We are shocked that this could happen at an academic library in the United States that claims to be a top-quality, comprehensive, master's-level institution.
One non-tenure-track library faculty member was let go at the end of June. 8 tenured and tenure-track library faculty found out in August that they will lose their jobs in mid-May. Those being laid off are the only employees of Western's library who have master's degrees in library science. Dunlap is worried the loss of trained librarians will hurt students.
Part of their tuition dollars is going directly to make sure that they have librarians here. And so they expected that. They should expect it. They deserve it. They're paying for it. And it's just wrong for students to not have the top quality professional librarians that other students at other state public universities in the state are receiving.
Dunlap recognizes Western faces budget challenges, and he knows the administration has talked about right-sizing the university. But he feels like the library has already taken hits through the years.
The library has more than been right-sized for this university. In fact, it's been now decimated.
He estimates the library had 60 to 70 employees a couple decades ago. Now they're down to the last 8 librarians and around 18 civil service workers. Dunlap says the civil service employees do great work, but they're not trained to do the work of librarianship. Cynthia Robinson was also shocked by what happened at Western's library.
I can't imagine a library without librarians.
Robinson is executive director of the Illinois Library Association. She says faculty members rely on librarians to help with research. Administrators also seek out information from librarians, and so do students, especially first-generation students who might not have enjoyed strong support from their libraries in high school.
That's what librarians are there for, to help the students, to help them with their research, to point them in the right direction.
Robinson says academic librarians have access to many databases, plus they can help students find materials that might not be online. WIU Board of Trustees member Keisha Lang voiced concerns about the library during the board's meeting in late September. Lang says she understands why budget cuts were made, but she wondered how the administration intends to proceed.
What is our plan to have the library function? Who's in charge of it? How do we move forward and still have it a place where it's productive?
Interim Provost Mark Mossman responded.
We do have a dean, Hector Meme Sugrains, who has developed a plan in consultation with the provost's office to make sure that we meet every single possible student need as we move forward with the library.
TSPR filed a FOIA request for the plan. The administration responded with a copy of a letter sent to members of CARLI, which is the Consortium of Academic and Research Libraries in Illinois. The letter says the provost office decided to prioritize the maintenance of collections and periodicals, as well as faculty instruction in the regular classroom. But Hunter Dunlap says the e-resources and collections librarian resigned last year and has not been replaced. Dunlap says it's fallen on him and another librarian to perform those duties. The letter also says the administration is considering a couple options. One is to hire librarians as staff members rather than faculty. The other is to create a new faculty librarian classification. They would teach courses half-time with the rest of their academic work done at the library. That would need to be negotiated with the faculty union. Dunlap says library faculty currently teach non-credit bibliographic instruction courses. He says there are a couple 4-credit courses on the books that librarians teach when enough students register for them. Whatever the administration's plan, Dunlap still cannot believe what's happening.
Libraries have historically been known as the heart of the university. And so to fire every single librarian really does kind of have an impact and does great harm to the university.
Dunlap says they've heard words of encouragement and support from colleagues across the nation. And he says they're working to bring state and national leaders in librarianship and higher education to Macomb, hold media events, and to stress the importance of libraries to universities. He says the librarians will not be quiet about a decision they believe will harm the university and its students. Rich Egger reporting.
In the fight against climate change, one technology aims to inject carbon emissions deep underground, and Illinois is on the forefront of what is becoming a booming business. But in recent months, residents have learned of leaks at the country's first commercial carbon sequestration facility, located in central Illinois. Now they're demanding more guardrails. Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco recently traveled to Decatur, and he has this story.
The nation's first commercial CO2 injection sites both sit beneath Lake Decatur. It's the primary source of water for the central Illinois city of about 68,000 people. And this is the first city council meeting since they all learned of a second leak at the site. Verlyn Rosenberger came prepared. She brings her folder filled with newspaper clippings and flyers to the podium.
Safe drinking water is vital to healthy life on Earth. Just because CO2 sequestration can be done doesn't mean it should be done.
This wasn't her first time addressing the council. She went up a couple weeks ago too, right after the reports of the first leak went public.
Pipes eventually leak. Thank you for listening.
The retired school teacher sat back down just in front of a row of executives from Archul Daniels Midland Company. ADM is a global agribusiness giant, headquartered in Chicago. Their Decatur facility is on the forefront of a booming multi-billion dollar carbon capture and storage industry, sometimes called CCS. The technology promises to permanently store planet-warming carbon dioxide deep underground. Biden's Inflation Reduction Act bet big on CCS, supercharging existing tax credits and setting off a CCS gold rush. The EPA is currently reviewing 150 new sequestration well applications, 22 in Illinois.
You should know that safety is our highest priority.
That's ADM's Greg Webb.
We simply wouldn't do this if we didn't believe that it was safe.
The EPA confirmed that the leaks had no impact on surface or groundwater sources, nor any threat to public health. But ADM detected the first leak in March and didn't say a word until months later. And while the public and lawmakers were still in the dark, ADM secured an easement from the city of Decatur to expand its operations. Decatur City Council member David Horn said at the meeting that information was substantial and relevant.
Had I known about the leak, I would not have supported approving the sequestration easement.
Illinois legislators and environmental advocates were also unaware of the leak, as they negotiated the state's first CCS regulations around the same time. ADM was part of those conversations and remained silent about the leak. So when Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker signed those same regulations into law at ADM's Decatur facility over the summer, he was unaware of the leak that had occurred more than 5,000 feet below his seat. It's unclear whether ADM was required by law to report the leak any sooner than they did. According to the company's permits, it only has to report major or serious emergencies. Neither the EPA nor ADM would comment to clarify.
ADM may not have been required by law to do so, but it certainly could be argued that they had an ethical responsibility to report the leak to interested parties, and they failed in that responsibility.
Horn says that in light of this lack of transparency, the regulations ought to be revisited and strengthened, particularly in terms of safeguarding an important aquifer that provides water to almost a million people in East and Central Illinois and spans 14 counties. State legislators plan to discuss two bills aimed at prohibiting carbon sequestration anywhere near the aquifer next month. In the meantime, several local governments are wondering whether they'll need their own restrictions. As the Decatur City Council meeting adjourned, Rosenberger helped her husband Paul put his coat back on.
I saw this whole row of ADM people behind me. I thought, I'm not afraid of them.
She said that she'll keep doing what she can where she can with the information she has. Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco, WBAZ News.
We're out of time for Statewide. Be with us again next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Remember, you can find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.